point. Okay, so yes, that's exactly where we are up to. We're up to the God speaking to the woman after the eating from the tree of knowledge. And we have this concept. So maybe let's just say that verse and then you can give that comment again, Serena. Ela Isha Amar, you see this in verse 16. Ela Isha Amar, to the woman, God said. Just previously he spoke to the snake. And now he's speaking to the woman. To the woman he said, Harbe harbe itzvonech veheronech. I will increase your pain in pregnancy. Be'etzev tel dibanim, in pain you'll give birth to children. Ve'elisheich teshukateich, and your desire will be for your husband. V'hu yimshol bach, and he will rule you. Very, very intriguing. Threateningly dangerous statement.
I don't know. I'm looking even at the slur generation for me in there. Not much changed.
Well, of course, this was thousands of years ago, but we do. So you were saying that someone didn't want to get married?
Yes, it's a true story. Two girls didn't want to get married because they didn't want to take the pain of birth.
The pain of childbirth?
Yes.
Interesting.
Yes. Grew old.
Yeah. And then it's interesting the way that today there are many people, particularly in the world as a whole, to some extent, certainly in the Jewish world and in the Hasidic world, where childbirth is seen as something extremely spiritual, very, very spiritual process, and on the part of the woman. For the woman, for the mother, as something extremely spiritual and holy. And I must say that's a very interesting aspect of this. And I think, there are women, some of whom I know, who assist in childbirth. My daughter, one or two or more, three even, of my own daughters, of our own daughters, do assist other women in childbirth, helping them experience it as something positive and spiritual and wholesome. And
but it is, I think, for most women, I'm surprised if it wasn't, in spite of the pain. And it used to be a midwife.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So their experience is
very wholesome.
Beautiful experience.
Yeah. Yes.
Just as spiritual as the other end of life, where death really don't equal, in my observation.
Have you also worked at that end as well? Yeah.
They take people into a different realm, both experiences, I think, and that's from a non-Jewish perspective.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, so it's... I think that what is included in this verse, it's not only physical pain, it's the complexity of the whole relationship, which leads to marriage, intimacy, childbirth. And that paradoxical situation that you will desire your husband and he will rule over you. So Rashi says, you will desire your husband, but you won't be able to say so. Because there's this intriguing certainly Western concept, and it may be further than that as well, that it's the man who proposes marriage to the woman. So the woman can be just longing for this man to say something, but no, they go out every evening. And whenever the conversation moves anywhere near the future, he veers off. And as Rashi puts it, she doesn't, she would be shy to say anything. It's not the woman who says, "Will you marry me?" Or
well, sometimes it is.
Shotgun marriage.
what I take from these verses more than that is actually it's vonech, which is really not pain but sadness. It's the whole, it's the concept of sadness, of unfulfillment of life, really. But there is this and it's to do with childbearing, with our children, it is to do with our relationship with our husbands, or family and extended family and all the rest, and the rest of life. Am I reading it right? I mean, it's not only about, it's vonech veronech, ve'esef tel dibalim. I think it is the whole experience of being a woman.
Well, there's this story of a group of middle-aged women who decide that they're going to go on a cruise together. So they all book tickets and they all come together in this beautiful, idyllic atmosphere. Blue sea moving off to the horizon. You know, there they all are on deck. And it's absolutely wonderful, balmy air. And then one of them, and another one says, "I thought we agreed not to talk about the children." Universal.
Yeah. You can't get away from it.
So that paradox, and in fact, in the Bible itself, in the Torah itself, one sees in terms of parents and children tremendous conflicts and anguish and disappointments and loss and sorrow and all the way through, but in a very powerful way. So it is, in a way, you know, these three little lines do include a whole package of relationships and the complexity of those relationships. But you see, one way of understanding the story from the Kabbalistic point of view, in terms of the sort of images that we have of these spiritual realms, divine, sacred sphirot, emanations, is that before eating from the tree of knowledge, there was some sense in which there was a harmonious structure to existence. And in existence there were negative things, but those negative things were in their place in a way which wouldn't disturb anything else. You see, if there's earth and dirt and rubbish in the dustbin, so that's where it's supposed to be. If it's put on the dining room table, then it's a problem. And the same here, there was a concept of good and evil. And evil is part of the structure of existence. But Adam and Eve didn't have to be conscious of evil because it wasn't a part of the structure that they needed to worry about. It's like, you know, one lives in a home. Now there are foundations to the home, you know, somehow underneath, or there are certain aspects of the earth under the house, and if certain things go wrong in the house, God forbid, so you have to have workmen in, they start digging, and there's clay and mud and different things. But normally, in the normal course of life, one doesn't have to see that, it's not part of it. And it's as if that's how it was for Adam and Eve, with the idea, interesting comment, that the problem for man or woman is that whenever we see or know about something, we're drawn to taste it, we're drawn to have some sort of more intimate or hands-on relationship with it. We can't just perceive, oh yeah, that's something negative and it's not for me. We're always that little bit more curious, and we get attracted by things and stuck into them. So the eating from the tree of knowledge was that step of going over a border, and going over a border in such a way that the negativity somehow spilled out everywhere, so that it's in every aspect of life, so that in fact all dimensions of life from that moment on are in some way mixed. And it's the struggle of a human being to take the positive dimension and leave the negative dimension. We're always confronted with a paradox, with two opposites at the same time, and we have to very carefully take the positive dimension and leave the negative. And so here we have the most intimate, important, beautiful dimension of life, husband and wife being connected together and bringing children into the world. And here, together with the passion and the love that they have for each other, and here it's all become something crooked, complicated, paradoxical, with all kinds of negative possibilities around it. In fact, the sages tell us, I mean, going back to the pure concept of childbirth and the person you were speaking about, Serena, later on in the Torah, it says that when a woman has a baby, she should bring an offering to the temple. And one of the offerings she brings is a sin offering. Now, there are different kinds of offering, and she brings a sin offering. Now, why on earth should a woman who's had a baby, which is the most wonderful thing, we can understand her bringing a Thanksgiving offering, you know, the different offerings we could imagine her bringing, why does she bring, among the other offerings, there's two, there's a burnt offering and a sin offering. Why does she bring a sin offering? So Rashi, quoting from the Talmud, he says that generally in the confronting childbirth, a woman might say, "Oi, never again."
And we all said that the first time we came back again.
And you know what? It's actually a second later that you say, "Oh, it's okay. When's the next one?" That's what I said. literally. I wasn't off the bed yet.
No, I was just trying to get it to swear in Hebrew, not in English.
I wasn't swearing exactly. All
you don't understand my Arabic.
Just a question, why? This is fairly early on.
Well, it's right at the beginning, yeah. Know.
And any thoughts on why evil is introduced so early?
Well, I think that's what makes it into an interesting story. If they'd have been in Garden of Eden 1,000 years, one has the feeling there wouldn't have been many headlines, you know. Another century of harmony has gone by.
That's quite quick. I mean, if you take experiences of life, okay, if you're perceptive and you're young and you happen to experience something that's not very nice, okay, but you know, it takes a while. I just wonder.
You mean it takes a while? You have to grow up a little bit to experience something negative.
Yeah.
Well, that's a very interesting point. Because one of the things about Adam and Eve, that although they are created on the sixth day of creation, they appear as fully grown people. So it's as if, you know, they've had the whole maturation process.
Yeah, that's
and here they are as real.
So
as
that's real. Why they have to bring the evil quickly.
Yes, within a week.
There's a very interesting idea, which, you know, we keep mentioning or exploring, which the Zohar says, that if they, in fact, the Talmud says virtually the same thing as well. If they had waited until Shabbat, they were created Friday, Adam and Eve, on the sixth day of creation. The beginning of creation is Sunday, when light was created, and then each of the days of the week, finally on Friday, the sixth day of creation, Adam and Eve are created. If they would have waited till Shabbat, then they could have eaten from the tree of knowledge. There wouldn't have been a problem.
Why?
Because on Shabbat, there is a harmony between those different dimensions of existence.
Does it still exist?
Yes, it does. That's why on Shabbat, that's when the physical is sanctified on Shabbat. I mean, there's always the idea of making our physical lives into a dwelling for the divine. And so that is in the physical dimension of life as well. But that's particularly so on Shabbat, when there's an idea of beautiful food and of guests and of a practical atmosphere of having meals together with candles on the table, all the beauty that goes into Shabbat, intimacy between husband and wife, that whole concept of the more earthly dimension of life being transformed into something sacred on Shabbat. So if they would have waited until Shabbat, they would have, as it were, slipped out of the paradox. The paradox would have been resolved. So in ordinary life, there are hitnakshiyot, there are conflicts of different kinds, and on Shabbat, those conflicts are resolved. It's a conflict between the physical and the spiritual. And on Shabbat, that is resolved. However, they were entering into this situation a little bit too soon. That's one way of reading it. Another comment, but that's what the Talmud says, a comment by the Zohar, is if they would have eaten from the tree of life before they ate from the tree of knowledge, then again, everything would have been all right. They would have been tapping a deeper spiritual source, which is so exalted that that too enables the opposites of soul and matter to dwell together. But they didn't do that. They tapped into the tree of knowledge, where they're confronted with the brute reality of this worldliness, of physicality. And there's all the time a kind of subliminal image of sexuality relating to this whole story with Adam and Eve and the serpent coming to Eve, the idea that the serpent desired Eve in some way, that there's some kind of lustful, illicit desire. And this opening this domain. And so the sin of the tree of knowledge, in some sense, has drawn aside a veil of innocence. There was innocence before. Everything was good. Intimacy was good. It was just simply holy. It was not complicated. And suddenly it becomes complicated. And that's why they said on the page before, that now we know we are naked, and so they covered themselves, they tried to cover themselves with leaves, because they could feel that being naked, there's something wrong with being naked, even though God created human beings, and everything God created must be beautiful, must be holy. And yet, nonetheless, they suddenly saw that there is a problem in this nakedness, and the nakedness has to be covered. It has to be hidden. Especially in relation to the divine. See, nakedness underlines the humanness or the animalness of a person. And the divine emphasizes a completely different dimension of our awareness, of our consciousness, and of our spirituality. So it's when they heard the voice of God in the garden, this is what made them feel. There's one of the commentaries in this little collection of Midrashim Yalkut Ruveni, that it was hearing God's voice in the garden and feeling the closeness of the divine, the ultimate purity, the infinite purity of God, suddenly made them feel how impure I am. Now that sense of the impurity, or the way in which the person is a smudge on the infinite purity of what's there, as it were, before the person or without the person, the sense of self as being some kind of smudge on the picture of existence. That's a rather difficult concept to grapple with.
Which we all have to grapple with.
But it's a very important one, because that enables one to recognize one's own self as something that we need to escape from, as something which is limiting us. And that's where the person is able to discover some deeper dimension of life, a deeper dimension of consciousness, where the ego and the self no longer trap that person. So the nakedness of Adam and Eve is really a concretization of ego and self manifested as their physical self, and then seeing the infinite holiness of godliness. And being aware that there's something wrong in some way, and this physical self has to be covered, and the ego, in relation to the divine, there is a step which the ego can make, and that's, could anyone suggest? I mean, what would be the step of the ego if the body covers itself? The person covers their body so as to hide their nakedness from the divine. But what's the step of the ego? What would we say?
A sort of self-defense mechanism, whereby puts up barriers.
Well, I'm looking for a more positive kind of relationship. I mean, I can see how that parallels the covering of the nakedness.
Well, then basically just fighting your, you know, subduing the ego, and really thinking of the other rather than
spiritual.
Yourself. Yes.
More spiritual.
Mm. Probably, yes. Bestowing to others. I mean, just trying to emulate God in a way of bestowing, doing things for others.
I think that's very true. I think that's an outcome. But I think the initial step is an acceptance of the divine. The divine is there, and the response to the divine is to accept the divine. And that's the submission of the ego. That, in fact, is the flaw which took place. God said, do not eat from the tree of knowledge, whatever that means in terms of our own personal life. And we say, well, I will. It's very attractive. And one reaches for that tree of knowledge, whatever that is in one's own life. But the counter step to that is that the divine addresses us with some kind of demand, and we say, I accept that, even though myself tends to this or tends to that, but I'm going to control it. I'm going to hold this back. So that's the equivalent, in a way, of covering nakedness. Covering nakedness means modesty. And modesty of the self is submission to the divine. Modesty, because the opposite of modesty of the self is, I want to do it, so I'm going to do it. No one's going to tell me what I should do. Whereas the contrary quality is to say, yes, God says not to do it, and I'm not going to do it. Now, the ability to surrender in that way is a very, on one level, it's a very primitive aspect of human nature, and on the other level, it's a very advanced aspect of human nature. And it's interesting that the two are together. In the whole process of modernity, from the 18th, 17th, 18th centuries into the modern world. Now, to a great extent, you know, the men who forged the Enlightenment, the French Revolution, they saw religious submission as something for the masses. Yes, Karl Marx later on spoke about the opium of the masses. Yes, that's the way you keep the masses quiet, just smoking their opium like rich people in opium den. And he rejected all that. But at another stage of history, a little bit later on, you get movements of people who say, you know what? That idea that you consider, that he considered the opium of the masses, that in fact is the greatest thing that a person is able to achieve. To be able to transcend one's own self and to be able to recognize the godliness in life and the divine teaching that there is addressed to every human being, to elevate that human being, to elevate the whole world. So there we are in this paradox of relationships to do with male and female. The whole story of Adam and Eve is about the purity, the beauty of the relationship between male and female. If you wanted to introduce someone to Jewish spiritual Kabbalistic teachings about marriage, one might well start with the story of Adam and Eve and the way in which originally they were one person together, back to back as it were, created back to back, male and female, and then they were divided by God and they became two different people, and then they unite together again and they become one. It's such a beautiful story, and in so many ways it is something relevant to our story today. And yet here we have, in the middle of that beautiful story, we have this complex part of it where there is pain and anguish and frustration and many things to keep therapists and counselors
very, very busy
occupied. Okay, so the fact of dealing with the complexity, the fact of having the complexity to deal with, I'd like to just give a very simple way of reading this whole story. There was a harmonious structure which was somehow damaged. And it's interesting that the actions of a man and a woman can damage in some way a spiritual structure created by God. And that really shows us the tremendous power that human beings have. There's a phrase, "Eto olam natan belibo." God puts the world in each person's heart. It's as if the world is this very, very delicate structure, and the fact that a person loses their temper or thinks negative thoughts of one kind or another, that they are in some way damaging that structure. The Kabbalists present it as divine names which become flawed because of what Adam and Eve did. In some way, certain divine names were harmed, and so then comes the process of trying to put that right. Or you can say that within the Sfirot, within the divine emanation, something went wrong. So the rest of the story, beginning here really, and even the paragraph before, facing the complexities of life and the contrary demands that are made on each person, that's the way we put right the structure that we in some way damaged. And so every time that we are confronted by anything negative and problematic, a person can think to himself, this is why I was created, in order to deal with this negative situation. And it's in this negative situation, or maybe I shouldn't even call it a negative situation, in order to deal with this situation. And by dealing with this situation in the right way, that's how I'm going to be able to put something right. And that is my task in life. As this great teacher, Rabbi Mendel Futterfuss, that I sometimes mention, he lived here in England for a time, and a Lubavitcher chassid, a Lubavitcher teacher, very inspiring person. And in the time of Stalin, he was put into prison in Russia for about 9 years. And eventually, thank God, he got out of prison and he got out of Russia and he came to England. That's where I met him and many other people. He lived in Israel as well. He said there were many people in prison who were deeply unhappy because they were not able to be what they felt they were. So, of course, in Stalin's time, you could have a school teacher was put into prison, or a general in the army, or a poet, or an actor or actress, that people were put in prison for all kinds of reasons. I heard of a child, there was a 10-year-old child in school, and he threw a pencil across the classroom, and it hit the picture of Stalin, which was on the wall. So that child and his whole family were sent to Siberia. So then, unfortunately, the Nazis came to that part of Russia and killed everyone. But he was safe because they were in Siberia. So later on, that child, when he'd grown up, he met a young woman who is now a lecturer in SOAS, a Russian lecture. He said, "Ah, you're from Georgia. I must thank you for your wonderful Georgian compatriot, Stalin, who saved my life." Saved my life by sending me to Siberia.
Irony of life.
Yeah, absolutely. So Reb Mendel said there were many people in prison who felt utterly frustrated. They couldn't be a teacher or a general or a scientist. Here they are in prison chopping wood. But he said, "You know, I have no problem. On that level, I have no problem. I felt, what is my task in life? To try to serve God. So I can try to serve God as a rabbi of a synagogue. I can try to serve God in a labor camp. I can try to serve God here. I can try to serve God there. Whatever the situation is, that's where I have to serve God." So there are different situations. And in those situations, you try your best to do what you feel that you are supposed to do. And so here we have that situation of the anguish and the problems with pregnancy, birth or whatever, and in relationship with one husband, relationship with one's children. That is la condition humaine, the human condition, and it's in that human condition that we are able to be the person that God has created, who is able to repair the world, letaken olam, to put right the world. That is really the ethos of Jewish teaching, that is the role of humanity. And I once heard a fascinating lecture saying that the some aspect of the Enlightenment drew on this idea that what we are trying to do is put right the world, and it transformed the way in which people saw what they were striving to achieve. In Western Europe. Okay, so let's take the next passage, Ula Adam Amar. Millie, would you like to read verse 17?
Ula Adam Amar, Ki shamata lekol ishtecha, betochal min ha'etz asher tziviticha le'emor, lo tochal mimeno. Arua ha'adama ba'avorecha, be'itzvon tochlena kol yimei chayecha.
Do you want to translate?
And to the man he said, "Because you listened to your wife, and you ate from the tree which I ordered you not to eat from, Arua Adam,
cursed
is the land because of you, Be'avurcha, Be'itzavon, in sadness, Tochlena kol yimei chayecha." I would translate it as hardship and sadness, you will cultivate it all the rest of your life. Or
All the days of your
life. All the days of your life.
Yeah, quite right.
Not
go
the
on.
Nights. Not the nights. Call your me.
Because the dardard at me achlach, the achalta et esev asade. Kotz v'dardar, beautiful. What is it in English? I don't know.
Thorns.
Oh, dardar, what is dardar?
Dardar is kibochatzatz. A rubble.
Stubble. Is it stubble? Rubble?
Rubble.
So it's a thorn and...
Thistles.
Thistles, yes.
Yeah, the English translation. Thistles,
yes. Will grow... will grow to you, it will grow to you, tatzmiach lach. Oh, I love that language, but it's difficult to translate. You do a much better job,
Tali. You're going to make a film of
it. and you shall eat the grass.
The grass of the field.
Of the field.
Remember, at this moment, Adam and Eve are vegetarian. And that's going to continue for something like 10 generations, that mankind at this point is vegetarian. So that's what they eat. They eat the grass, the herbs, the corn, whatever it might be. But they don't eat animals. Bezeya tapecha. Would anyone else like to read it? Would you like?
בזיעת הפרח תאכל לחם אל שוכל אדמה כי ממנו לקחת כי עפר אתה ואל עפר תשוב ויקרא אדם שם אשתו חווה כי הוא הייתה עם כל חי ויעש אדוני אלוהים לאדם ולאשתו קנות אור ולבשם.
Wait. Would you like to translate? Bezeat hapecha. We go very slowly.
Bezeat hapecha.
You've just gone into 1972. Bezeat hapecha.
Sweat of your...
With the sweat of your face, sweat the sweat of your brow, it's often translated. Tochal lechem, you shall eat bread. Ad shuvchai l'adama, until you return to the ground. That idea of man, humanity, coming from the ground and returning to the ground. And so Adam, the word Adam relates to the word Adama, earth. So there's earth and there's Adam, man. And so he comes from the ground and then returns to the ground. And the sages tell us the point in the ground from which Adam was born, was formed, Adam and Eve, was from the earth at the point of the altar in the temple in Jerusalem. So that point of the altar in the temple in Jerusalem, that is the focal point for humanity. Because it's from there that Adam and Eve were formed, right at the beginning.
You're saying Gan Eden is in Jerusalem?
That's just what I was wondering.
Well,
no, we talked about that. It's a different realm, actually.
Well, it's interesting. You know, is Gan Eden a limited place, or is it a dimension of world? How do we fit these, you know, on one level, Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden, is a realm which is to the east, somewhere to the east of Israel. But at the same time, there are images such as Adam and Eve being created from the earth of the altar in Jerusalem. And in fact, the tradition is that Adam offered offerings to God, korbanot. He brought offerings to God, and he brought them at that site of the altar in Jerusalem. So we would say that he is there in Jerusalem in some sense. So you will return, because from that earth you were taken, ki mimena lukachta, from that earth you were taken, for you are earth. And you will return to earth. You will it's often translated dust. You are dust and you will return to the dust, or earth, you return to the dust. So let's just take that for the moment, and then we'll look at the last verse, or the last two verses here, in this paragraph. So in other words, God has spoken to the woman, and now God is speaking to the man. And the man has a complexity that he listened to his wife telling him to eat from the tree of knowledge. It's very interesting that the first Jew, Abraham, who on one level is seriously working to put everything right, given that everything has gone wrong in all kinds of different ways, to an even greater, much greater extent by the time we get to the generation of Abraham, when people are serving idols and burning their children in fire and doing all kinds of negative things. Abraham was told by God, everything your wife tells you to do,
you do.
Do it. Lily has this written on a plaque.
And I do.
We do it all the time. It's
the only way to survive.
Full of contradiction.
So...
That balances up nicely, doesn't it? With the authority that's given over him when they get married.
I think I know
he will dominate.
Is. It's a logic loop. This can't possibly work. That's what the problem is. The programming's wrong.
Yes.
Well, is it wrong or is it right? I mean, that's the... you see, man mastering woman that we had before. The problem for the woman is that he will master you. You will desire him, but he will master you. And there we have, you know, a sort of fairly typical male chauvinist structure of men and women and the way they relate to God. And yet, in a sense, the tikkun, the healing of the world, is a reversal of that structure. The Lubavitcher Rebbe spoke about the difference between male and female in the following terms. The Talmud says, Ish dako lichbosh. The nature of man is to conquer. So there is this forceful, aggressive, massive... Jack's looking very peaceful. There's this forceful...
His wife dominating him.
Well, you know, there were two cues. One of two lines of men. One was the line of men who do what their wives tell them, and the other one, the line who tell their wives what to do. So there were huge crowds of men who do what their wives tell them, and there was one man standing in the queue of he tells his wife what to do. And someone said to him, that's wonderful, you know, congratulations, here you are, the only man who tells your wife what to do, that's fantastic.
My wife
He said, my wife told me to stand here.
He said, you tell me what.
Men have the last word always. They always say amen to everything that she says.
Amen.
Amen. Last word.
I like the story about the man who said, I haven't spoken to my wife for a week because she's still speaking to him.
Present company.
Exactly.
So, ish dako lichbosh, the man has the quality of conquering, aggressively conquering. And the woman, this is how the Lubavitcher Rebbe depicts womanhood. The woman has the power to make a person feel that that's what he wanted to do. That's a very interesting, you know, it's not forcing someone.
But it's a very, very smart woman. It's not shrewd, it's smart woman. She has to be very clever.
And what the Rebbe suggested is that in our age, men should adopt the mode of womanhood. it's a more suitable mode. But instead of trying to force people to do things, we should try to win people.
Like Obama.
Hmm?
Like Obama.
Yes,
yeah, very good example.
Excellent. That is the postmodern style of trying to make a person feel that this speaks for me. And the in a sense, that is what Hasidic teaching is all about. One can contrast modes of religious teaching. One kind of religious teaching is simply a command, which is telling you, you've got to do this and you mustn't do that, and you can't ask questions. And then there's another dimension where the question becomes ennobled. You've got a question, yeah, that's a very important thing. That question, it's a very real and deep and important question. That's and somehow enable the person to discover where they are on the page, that they are there and it's me, it relates to me. That's the secret. And the Rebbe presented this as the feminine approach, the feminine power, which really should be the dominant power. And it was, in many ways, that was what the Rebbe was teaching, this approach to Jewish thinking. That it's not something that you feel, oh, I must do this and I must do that. Yes, there are musts, but within those musts, there is the discovery that this is my reality and that is my reality, and discovery of oneself in them. So that process is now applied to the man, and let's have a look at a few of the details which are there. So on the one hand, there's this whole intriguing concept of his relationship with his wife. Does he listen to his wife, or does she listen to him? Or ultimately, does he listen to her in a very deep way because he recognizes that she has a very great spiritual connection and he can learn from that? So that's one step. Then we have the whole nature of working the land. Now, working the land in the Torah is a deeply spiritual aspect of life in itself. The Jewish festivals revolve around the agricultural year. There is Sukkot will be the next major festival. That is the festival of the harvest season, the time of threshing and harvesting.
It feels as if we just had Sukkot.
Mm-hmm. We just.
It feels as if.
We just had Sukkot. Yeah.
Well, the Sukkot taking
we just turn the wheel round and it's another year. And another year. With good health, with the help of God. So that's Sukkot. And then we have Pesach, which is the beginning of the barley harvest. And then Shavuot, which is the wheat harvest. And then finally Sukkot again, the end of the harvest season. And so there's this agricultural cycle, which is really sacred. Working the land is something in itself sacred. The rain falling on the soil, the plowing, the planting, it's all a spiritual interaction with the earthliness of the sacred land of Israel. And here, there's a complexity which is introduced. It's a little bit parallel to the beautiful relationship that there should be between male and female, husband and wife, which we saw, and the whole idea of a family, which in the previous paragraph we saw how complicated that becomes, that everything, the relationship between husband and wife, the fact of childbirth and bringing up children, all becomes an extremely complicated process. And here we have those same complications introduced into working the land, which should be a beautiful, fulfilling feeling that you plowed the land and you planted the seeds and the rain fell and the crops are growing, everything working in the right way. And instead, kotz v'dar da tatzmiach lach, there'll be thorns and there'll be thistles or whatever they are, instead of the crops, the wheat, the grain that you wanted to grow, there's going to be foreign growths, which are weeds, which will be taking over. And it'll be a problem for you, and you'll have to work with the sweat of your brow in order to make a living. Now, we may not be farmers today, all of us. But that idea of working with the sweat of one's brow does indeed continue, because there are all kinds of ways in which a person has to really put tremendous effort and energy in order to make a living. And instead of a person thinking, look, it's a beautiful world, why couldn't it just be in some, you know, absolutely relaxed way? In fact, there's a lot of demands on the person. I know a gentleman who, he went to the Rebbe and he was talking with him about his livelihood. Now, it's interesting that a Hasidic Rebbe, Hasidic teacher, on the one hand, he's a great scholar of Jewish thought in all its aspects, and many aspects of thought. And he could talk to a person about the most profound aspects of Torah study or spirituality. But he also helped people deciding what they're going to do in life and giving blessings for finding, well, a very spiritual part of life, finding the right person to marry and getting married and being happy and healthy together, physical health, and also making a living and giving people blessings and guidance as regards to making a living. Now, this person came to the Rebbe and he told the Rebbe what he was doing. And the Rebbe said to him, this is how this person told me. He quoted this verse, "Bezeya tapecha tochal lechem." With the sweat of your brow you eat bread. And this person, he's now basically retired and lives a really idyllic life in Israel, where he spends most of his day studying and you know, doing very spiritual things, giving shiurim. But at that point, he was working, and he was working really hard. It was an incredibly active, energetic business that he was running and very, very much involved. And for him, the fact that the Rebbe told him, with the sweat of your brow you will eat bread, he felt, that's fine. I don't have to feel that I'm not doing what I'm supposed to do. This is what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to be working. And he felt the meaning in that. It's an interesting approach to life, to see this is what I'm supposed to be doing. A person can be very unhappy simply because they feel the injustice of their situation. But if one feels this is exactly what I'm supposed to be doing, and so I should be getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and I should be doing this, and I should be doing that, that's the situation. That's human life. So the idea of taking one's life and experiencing it in a positive way, whatever the ups and downs, whatever the challenges that are there, I think this verse really encapsulates it. Now, it doesn't have to be difficult, and for some people it's not. And even in the case of these generations, these early generations in the creation of the world that we're talking about, the sages tell us that there came a point where that curse on the earth dissolved away. So we have the time of Cain and Abel, which is going to be not very far ahead. And Cain worked the soil, whereas Abel had lambs, he had sheep. And so the sages tell us that he didn't want to work the soil because of this curse, as it were, which was on working the soil. But later on, that curse itself dissolved away. And so there are transformations there as well, and it doesn't have to be in a way a negative way, it can be in a positive way. And nonetheless, the idea that by the sweat of one's brow one works, and the image that life, Adam la'amal yulad, man is created to work. And that concept, taking that in a positive way, that really is the challenge of existence. Vayikra ha'adam. Oh, 1 second. So then we have the idea of going back to the earth. And that itself, of course, that's the physical part of the person, going back to the earth, and the spiritual part of the person is eternal. And that sense of contact with the spiritual part of the person, that's a very important dimension of people's lives. It's also there at the grave, and for that reason we have the idea of visiting a grave of a departed relative or of a great tzaddik, a great person, because there is some kind of spiritual connection with the person when one is visiting that grave. And so that is so that dimension of this cycle of life. And then we finally come to the calling of names, because it's the of special names, because Adam was calling names. He was giving names to the animals. He was giving each animal its name in Hebrew, the sacred language. Incidentally, one of the commentaries on this whole story says if Adam and Eve had not eaten from the tree of knowledge, Hebrew would be the only language. That would be the language of humanity. That was the language of creation, and that would be the language of existence. The fact that there was the sin of the tree of knowledge, that eventually led to the situation much later after the flood, that there would be the Tower of Babel, and as a result of that there would be 70 different languages, which are the roots of all the different languages in the world today. But the, is that your mother? That's so that would be the so Hebrew would be the only language. In the 16th century in Britain there was the belief that if you brought up a child without any human contact, without any linguistic contact, he would grow up naturally speaking Hebrew. maybe the 17th century. It's an aspect of millenarianism in the 17th century.
Right.
So,
where did that derive from?
Well, the idea that Hebrew is the natural language of existence. It's the divine language. It's the language with which the world was created. It's the language of the Torah, of the Bible. I mean, this was, in Western Europe, that was a fairly universal concept, particularly in Protestant England. It's
Why there were lots of non-Jewish people that wanted to learn Hebrew.
Well, there still are. Yes.
Yes.
That's very true.
Yeah.
Yes, that's true. And the beauty of Hebrew. That's I hear today that one of the foremost grammarians of the Hebrew language is Japanese. So Hebrew has a tremendous magnetism. So Adam, it's a very interesting thing. Adam was contributing to the Hebrew language by giving the names of the different animals. Because there's the idea that the Hebrew word for something is not just a sort of an agreed word. You know, why in English do we say salt? Or in French, du sel? Or in German, salz? What is it in Russian?
Salt.
Salt. Okay. So there are those different words which somehow or other, it's this in this language, that in another language, you can trace all kinds of roots, Indo-European language families. But when we say, everyone studied a bit of chemistry, when we say NaCl, sodium chloride, that's not because of an agreement. I mean, that is actually what salt is. Salt is an atom of sodium and an atom of chlorine, and that's what sodium chloride, that's what common salt is. You can have potassium chloride itself. Instead, if people want to have a low sodium diet, so you have another similar substance, potassium chloride. But basically, common salt is sodium chloride, and the way to signify sodium chloride is NaCl. So that's, in a sense, the reality of what salt is. Now, one could say that the Hebrew word for salt, melach, that is the real nature of salt. Those three letters, mem, lam, and chet, they are actually the spiritual essence of salt. Mm. And so in the case of everything else in existence, the chair, the table, the Hebrew word for that object is its real spiritual dimension. So when Adam is giving names to the animals, he is perceiving the depth of that animal, and he's giving a name which accords with the inner spiritual essence of that animal. So it's interesting that we have the idea of Hebrew being a sacred language, a language of the upper world in some sense, the language of the divine in creating the world, and at the same time, Adam has a role in giving these names, in giving these words. And then he turns to his wife. Vayikra ha'adam shem ishto Chava. He called the name of his wife Chava, Eve. Ki hi haita ein kol chai, because she was the mother of every living human being, every human being coming from her, and she is the mother of all life, and the word chai, life, that relates to chet yud, the yud relates to a vav, so it becomes the word Eve. So Eve, Chava, relates to the concept of life, and she is the mother of life. And that is the deep nature of womanhood. In our diagram of the Sfirot that we often look at, with the 10 divine emanations, the lowest of the 10, the 10th Sfira, is the Sfira, is Malchut, kingship. And that represents the feminine. And from kingship emerges the whole realm of all the different worlds which come below. And that's the nature of womanhood, giving blessing, bringing blessing into the world. And that power of Eve as the first woman, and then of all women, that is something which continues through existence. And then, Vayas Hashem Elokim la'adam v'ishto, God made for man, for Adam and his wife, Kotnot Or, garments of skin, Vayalbishem, and he clothed them. So it's very interesting that the step to clothe their nakedness, which is in a way where the whole story began. The story began with Adam and Eve being naked and not being ashamed. Then comes the whole story of the snake and the tree of knowledge. And then they were ashamed. And now God is giving them clothes, and they clothe themselves. And this word, clothes of skin, I mean, it could be clothes of fur, that might be one way of understanding it. Or it might be some skin-tight clothing, rather futuristic. Mm-hmm. But Rabbi Meir was a great sage, and this word, he wrote it slightly differently. No doubt with some kind of spiritual tradition that he was following. Instead of writing Or with an ayin, meaning skin or leather, it could be, he wrote it with an aleph, meaning light. Light. Kotnot Or, clothes of light. And it's interesting that clothing, on the one hand it covers, but on the other it reveals. Because the way in which a person dresses expresses what kind of person they are and what they're aspiring to. So there is a sense in which the clothing hides and also the clothing reveals in a deeper way.
If it was skins or fur, then they must have had to kill animals in order to produce that.
That's an interesting point, and maybe that's why it's God who's providing it and not... In fact, the general way that the rabbis speak about it is as a kind of skin covering to them, rather than... Well, I think we've reached a point that we can...
Can I ask a question? I don't think it's relating to... No, it is relating to the curse of Chava. What is the place of Lilith in all these stories? And I know it is a negative, it's a negative, that's all I know.
Lilith.
It's the negative aspect of womanhood, isn't it?
Well,
what?
Now, there's a concept called Lilith. Now, Lilith is a figure in the Midrash and Zohar. And as Millie says, she represents a negative aspect which could be seen as a negative aspect of womanhood. It's part of the paradox of womanhood, that on the one hand, womanhood can be the most ennobling and bringing the greatest goodness and harmony and beauty to life, and on the other hand, there is the, if you look in the book of Proverbs presents two women, the woman of wisdom, the woman of valor, and a negative image of the woman who in some way is negative, is a temptress, is a drawing a person away from where they should be. And so that negative possibility one can see as part of the mystique, if you like, of Lilith. And Lilith represents a spiritual quality of negative femininity. And it's an aspect of the realm of the Klipot, the realm of the shells which conceal godliness. And so there is a way of describing Adam, that what the problem with Adam and Eve and the serpent is Adam in some way having or wanting to have relations with Lilith. In other words, some kind of illicit. It's the flaw in Adam that he allows himself to be tempted by the wrong form of womanhood. And maybe that is really the focus of the story, because what kind of relationship is Adam looking for? And if it's something which is wholesome, then it will be Adam and Eve, and she will be the mother of all life in a positive way. And if Adam allows a more coarse and primitive dimension in himself to become dominant, then instead of Eve and everything positive, it becomes Lilith and everything negative. And so there is that. Now it's interesting that in Chabad Hasidic teaching, which takes from the Kabbalah, it takes, it sort of steers a line through Kabbalistic thought, Lilith does not appear very much. Because the Chabad approach, I would say, is that womanhood is positive, and that there are good choices to make, and one focuses on the good. There is a style of Kabbalistic teaching which is very fascinated by the negative and the evil, and not getting, you know, and nearly getting caught in the evil, or getting caught in the evil. And it's as if these pious Kabbalists, you know, were, you know, there's the, some way of reading their writings, you know, where the quality of Lilith becomes such a, and other negative aspects,
yes.
become very, very powerful, and the you know, the exultancy in not giving in to the temptation becomes a serious issue. Whereas I think from the Chabad point of view, one goes at a different level. It's not a matter of temptation. You know, the woman, the tempting woman, Nebuch. What she needs to do is light a candle for Shabbat. That's, you know, that's not what she means.
That's educator, yes. Yes, but the reality is that there is this dark side.
Well, there's a dark side, but from the illumination of Hasidic thought, the dark side itself is not really dark and can be illuminated.
Which I absolutely endorse. I think it's beautiful.
So there's nothing so low that it can't in some way be elevated. I mean, that's a challenging concept, you know, when you think of different kinds of problematic life. But but it is there as an ideal that God created a good world. And sometimes some of that goodness gets covered over. And sometimes it's us human beings who do the covering. But we should know that there is goodness underneath.
Do you think Lilith is possibly the other side of Eve, that they're one and the same, and that in all of us there is the good and the evil, and that there isn't this perfect woman, and there isn't an utterly, maybe what you were saying, there isn't an utterly black Lilith, and maybe it's the two sides of a person?
Well, you see, the demonic Lilith is a bit too steep for the real woman, for the real person. One can speak about a divine soul and an animal soul. One can speak about a good desire and a bad desire. But a bad desire is still a few steps off from Lilith. So one doesn't have to see any person as falling into that. And if we encounter someone who is living a tragic life, our response should be to try to lift them out of that life and help them, and not to see. You see, Lilith represents something in the clutches of forces of evil, you know, which when we begin seeing people in that kind of way, even if we're going to say, well, there was a choice, could have been good, but whoever it is, there is that goodness somewhere hidden away. And it's really a matter of focusing on the point of goodness within the person and trying to lift that up, which can be very challenging. Because there are all kinds of situations in life where you say, I just can't see that point of goodness. And nonetheless, in order for us to live in the world, in a harmonious way, I mean, we can live in the world in a very unhappy way, or, you know, suffer, unfortunately, as a result of the negativity of the world. But if we are somehow able to see the world in a different way, challenging as that is, then we get through the image of Lilith or any corresponding qualities, and we're just seeing the good potential of the person. The person has a good potential, even if what they've done up to now is 100% negative. You can describe an action as being 100% negative, but the person doing the action, so where are they and what is their potential? The same person who has done something negative or repeatedly has also got a potential for positive. And to end on this note, that the sages tell us that the power of good is many times stronger than the power of bad. And they quote various verses to prove that the power of good is 500, they're very mathematical, you see. The power of good is 500 times better than the power of bad. Why? Because God says he will be angry for four generations with those who are bad, and he will be happy with 2,000 generations with those who are good. So that means that the quality of goodness is 500, 4 into 2,000 equals 500, is 500 times more. Now just think of the damage that people can unfortunately achieve through negativity, right? A few people working together in a negative way can cause tremendous, tremendous destruction. If that's the case negatively, just think of the power of good that can be achieved. And so it's that dimension, and in the sense that the feminine is not only womanhood, it's worldliness, it's existence, it's creation, it's this world. And what we've been talking about are the paradoxes of this world. And the idea that we can cut through, go through, visually see through the paradox and see a redeemed world and open our eyes and see a world which is wholeness and goodness and harmony and love, that is what the Torah is teaching us.
Thank you.